Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am under-caffeinated.
I am over-caffeinated and really happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, does Hollywood have some splaining to do? That was the thought around Tinseltown after Trump selected J.D. Vance, the author of the best-selling memoir Hillbilly Elegy, which, of course, was turned into a movie of the same name. He was selected to be the vice presidential candidate for Donald Trump in 2024. I don't know why he didn't go with Mike Pence again. It seemed like a good fit first time around. Maybe something happened between the two of them. Who can say? Vance, now the senator from Ohio, has undergone something of an evolution over the last few years. He burst onto the scene as the coastal media preferred hillbilly whisperer. His memoir was just putting up Ta-Nehisi Coates-style sales numbers after it was seen by some as a key to understanding the voters who swept Donald Trump into the White House by helping him shatter the vaunted blue wall in the Midwest, right? That white working class vote that he turned out so well. Vance, at this point in history, was a contributor to the New York Times, the Atlantic, other venerable mainstream media outlets. He was still calling Trump a potential Hitler. Fun times. Hollywood decided that Vance's rags-to-riches story was one worth telling, and tell it they did. Netflix spent about $45 million bringing Hillbilly Elegy to screens, large and small, mostly small. It got a small Oscars qualifying run. That was directed by Ron Howard. Amy Adams and Glenn Close starred as Vance's mother and grandmother, respectively. Hillbilly Elegy was positioned as one of Netflix's big award season plays in 2020, which turned kind of awkward because Vance had stopped calling Trump Hitler and started supporting him and sucking up to him in the hopes of securing his support in a future senatorial bid. Eventually, Vance did run for office, and he won that Senate seat in Ohio, though he needed lots of money from billionaire Peter Thiel to get over the finish line a couple short years later, and now he is Trump's VP nominee, which brings me back to Hollywood. Trade publications like Variety and The Ankler, love Variety, they suggested that Hollywood needs to do some soul-searching for giving Vance a glow-up and bringing his story to the masses. Is Vance the ultimate celebrity apprentice? Did the Hollywood gauze give him a leg up with the people? I'm going to be honest, cards fully on the table here. I'm very skeptical that any significant number of voters in the Ohio Senate campaign decided that J.D. Vance was the guy they should vote for because they saw a bad awards bait movie about his life that, like, actually jettisoned everything that was interesting about his life and instead kind of turned it into a kind of dull poverty porn that focused on the acting shenanigans of Glenn Close and Amy Adams, who both give fine performances, don't get me wrong. The book was tremendously influential. The book, hugely influential. Big deal. I think it absolutely set him up for the run. The movie, I don't see it. The only real way this might have impacted anything is that Trump heard, ooh, they made a movie about this guy, and then he wanted to talk to him about, like, what Amy Adams was doing on set. You know, get a little bit of the goss, get a little bit of the gossip. That's funny, and it's kind of sad. You should say everything we need to say about Donald Trump and what he's looking for in a VP, but, you know, whatever. The big question, though, is, so what if the movie did change some minds? Here's my broader point, right? Vance's story is an interesting one, and it's worth telling. Or it isn't interesting, and it isn't worth telling. And neither of those factors really have anything to do with whether or not he is a MAGA politician, right? Forcing yourself to tiptoe around potentially aiding some political adversary or some future political adversary at some point in the unforeseeable, far-off distance. You can't make art like that. You can't be like, well, what if this helps some bad person someday do something that we don't want? I'm sorry. Like, unless Ron Howard and Brian Grazer at Imagine are sitting down and making actual campaign ads for J.D. Vance, they've got nothing to apologize for. Hollywood, I think, is pretty much in the clear here, at least in terms of influencing the electorate, that sort of thing. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just one of these separate the art and the artist guys. Maybe I'm crazy like that. Peter, should Hollywood feel the need to wear a hair shirt for bringing J.D. Vance's story to the masses?
Oh yeah. I turned on Netflix right before we taped this episode. And, like, one of the top five tiles that they were offering me was Hillbilly Elegy. I didn't ask for that. I didn't like that movie. I watched it the one time and never went back. I don't think I've watched anything that feels like Hillbilly Elegy, so I don't know why the algorithm is giving me Hillbilly Elegy unless it's just like, well, you like Star Wars. And Ron Howard did do that one Star Wars movie, kinda, sorta, after somebody else had been working on it for like 2 years. He stepped in and did it and took, and you know.
Solo.
Solo. Right, like what? It's Netflix's fault. I think this is actually Sonny, I wanna argue with you specifically because I understand that you have a separate the art and the artist view here, but you also like to blame Netflix for not releasing movies theatrically. And sure, there was a token theatrical run for Hillbilly Elegy, but this was a streaming product first and foremost, and like, doesn't that make you upset? Doesn't that offend your sense of aesthetic justice? This is an opportunity
You're trying to make some weird point here, and I don't understand it. But what I'll say is here's what I will say to this point though specifically about TV versus theatrical is that if Netflix it was a traditional studio, if it was like a Universal or a Warner Brothers, there would have been a million ads for this movie on TVs. There would have been a massive increase in J.D. Vance's name recognition because there would have been an actual campaign around it. Or at the very least, the idea of this guy from Ohio who's got the great personal story. There would have actually been an increase in general awareness. And here's the thing. I believe two things simultaneously. I believe more people probably saw Hillbilly Elegy than ever read Hillbilly Elegy, just on like pure numbers, right? Because more people see a movie than read a book. We can all agree on that, right? Even a big hit book like Hillbilly Elegy probably gets seen by more people on Netflix than read the actual book.
That's probably true, though we don't know. And yeah. we just have no idea how many people saw it on Netflix.
That's the thing, is we don't actually know. But let's say it's true. Let's grant that. Even if we grant that, I think the movie was so bad and so bland and so unbelievably forgettable that it didn't change anybody's mind. Even the ones who saw it were probably like, yeah, that's the one where Amy Adams, she's the junkie and she's trying to win an Oscar, that right?
So I was mostly trying to turn this into, you know, an opportunity for like Sonny to change his mind because of theatrical exhibitions and I mostly joking here. But this is exactly right. This movie was not just bad and bland. The movie was clearly, I want to say explicitly, but there wasn't like a statement from Ron Howard, but so clearly the main thing that they did with this movie was strip all of the interesting political stuff out of it it was like they really wanted to tell this story, but they wanted to also make sure that it couldn't possibly mean anything to anyone or be about anything other than this one little narrow story that like, oh, but you know, we wouldn't want to infer anything from it. Where the book is literally the opposite. It is entirely about the inferences and the politics and the cultural context of it. And to say that the movie version somehow or another is what gave us this particular iteration of J.D. Vance on the Trump ticket is just bizarre. Again, because even if you want to say there's some sort of politics going on here in this movie, right? Because of what it was attached to, the thing it was attached to was an anti-Trump view of the world that said, look, these people have problems. We need to pay attention to them and respect them. But also blame the casting view of the world in which it's all someone else's fault is the wrong view. It's just bizarre to say Hollywood has any responsibility here. They have responsibility for making a bad movie.
Yeah, Alyssa, this is a thing we talked about when we did this show for Across... Yes. We did a show on Hillbilly Elegy for Across the Movie Aisle. And it's one thing we talked about was just how it really did take everything that was kind of interestingly political out of the story entirely.
Yeah. And I mean, if there's anyone to blame for like J.D. Vance, the phenomenon, it's really more the publishing industry than Hollywood. Because, you know, Hillbilly Elegy is very successfully sold as this sort of explanation for why people voted for Donald Trump. And you know, when we did this, when the movie came out, when we did the episode, I went back and reread Hillbilly Elegy because I hadn't read it for a while. And it's amazing the extent to which the book itself is about, like, yes, there is sort of this political gloss and there's political argument, but it's also about just this terribly interpersonally dysfunctional family, right? Like, I mean, I apologize for doing the gross thing where you quote from your own piece, but, you know, this is the description of Vance's family life in a way that, like, really cannot be explained by politics, right? Like, the fights between his mother, Bev, and one of her partners taught Vance to, quote, never speak at a reasonable volume when screaming will do. If the fight gets a little too intense, it's okay to slap and punch so long as the man doesn't hit first. Always express your feelings in a way that's insulting to your partner. Bev tried to kill herself repeatedly, once by threatening to crash a speeding car while her son was riding with her. And one of the book's heroes, Vance's beloved grandmother, Mama, she took Vance in and set high expectations for him. He saw her as his protector. Mama was also the person who set her husband on fire to get him to stop drinking, who said of her own daughter, if she wanted to kill herself, I've got plenty of guns, and who tried to dissuade Vance from joining the military by calling him an idiot, they'll chew you up and spit you out. When Mama and Bev finally struck a deal that allowed Vance to choose to live with his grandmother, the enforcement mechanism was, quote, that Mama would kill anyone who tried to keep me from her, right? Like, the idea that this was a book where, like, some of his personal suffering, you know, yeah, there are some sort of larger sociopolitical things here, but Vance's own family has a dynamic that, you know, is, I don't think you can explain those interpersonal dynamics with politics, right? And so to a certain extent, what's really interesting about the book is that Vance is doing kind of exactly the same thing that he accuses the people that he's criticizing of doing, right? He's saying, you know, he's delivering this tale of just, like, horrible personal woe and saying that it has political meaning. Whereas at the same time that he's saying the people who he grew up with, you know, their lives were shaped by politics in certain ways, but they sort of interpreted those, you know, their personal sufferings in a way that were, that was political, sort of unmoored from the actual evidence. And so, you know, I think that the publishing industry turned this book that really is much more illustrative as sort of personal memoir into something that it was not. And that, you know, to a certain extent that the publishing industry, that any, you know, sort of industry can be blamed for making J.D. Vance a national figure. It's much more the publishing industry than Hollywood. But J.D. Vance is sort of, at least not, you know, in his public life, kind of recognizable as the same ideological figure he was 4 years ago or 8 years ago, which makes it really hard to blame anybody for any of this.
Yeah, he didn't have a beard back then.
That's an important change. I think this is, you know, Hollywood loves to think of themselves as the myth makers of the world. They are the ones who, you know, kind of set the agenda for everyone. And I this is one of these situations where I would just caution everybody out in Hollywood and the entertainment industry more broadly that, like, you don't have to take responsibility for this one. It's fine. This is more on the news industry, frankly. I blame the folks in my industry more than I blame the folks in Hollywood for, you know, kind of setting Vance up as this great sage.
Everyone's rushing to not take credit for this happening. That's
weird.
To take blame.
Yeah. J.D. Vance is the hot potato that nobody wants to catch.
But it seems like Sonny's like, no, it's my fault.
It's not my fault. It's the other people in my industry.
I think it's Sonny's fault. It's a little bit Sonny's fault.
All the rest of you people out there in publishing. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that Hollywood made a biopic about a guy who would go on to be the vice presidential candidate with Donald Trump in 2024? Alyssa.
It's no more controversial than the making of South Side with You, the incredibly terrible Barack and Michelle Obama meet cute movie. It's entirely predictable. It's the kind of thing Hollywood does all the time. Non-troversy.
Peter.
Non-troversy.
I say it's a controversy, though. Alyssa, your answer there reminds me that I do think that Hollywood still has to take some blame for that Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie, which helped really kind of in really puff up the, you know, the sense of RBG as grand historical figure who can never leave, and that had some bad.
There are a lot of people who are responsible for that.
That's another episode. That's a whole other thing. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus this Friday for a bonus episode on Hollywood's role. We're still talking about Hollywood in politics here, in propping up the Joe Biden campaign and then forcing him out of that campaign. From Jeffrey Katzenberg's fundraising and image making to George Clooney's New York Times op-ed, Tinseltown has played a big role over the last few months here in the world of the Democratic primary / whatever it is now, presidential picking. We're going to discuss it. Now on to the main event, something a little bit less serious. Twisters, the sequel / remake of the 1996 Jean d'Abont disaster film starring Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton, blew into theaters last week, and it blew audiences away. It racked up an enormous $80 million opening weekend. Good for it. The story here is pretty straightforward. Kate, who is played by Daisy Edgar Jones, is a country gal who flees to the big city after her tornado-chasing crew gets sucked up by an F5 during one of their experiments. She returns to Oklahoma, where her friend Javi, who's played by Anthony Ramos, convinces her that she can help him map the interior of a tornado, which with a fancy new radar system that he got from the military. I don't know. They use it to map tornadoes. Understanding how the tornadoes will work on the inside will help her fine-tune her model for using absorbents to kill the tornadoes before they get going, maybe? Who knows? The two of them run into a YouTube celebrity tornado wrangler, which is a fun little tidbit, nice little update from 1996. His name is Tyler. He's played with very strong, good old boy energy by Glenn Powell. He's the sort of guy who gets his team out to shoot fireworks up into a tornado for views on social media. But don't worry, they've got hearts of gold. All their merchandising sales are funneled. Get it? Into meals distributed to communities hit by the storms they're chasing. The plot of this film is about as disposable as you'd hope it would be. Like something, something, evil land developers, something, something, tornadoes go boom. Something, something, pretty people on screen together. You like to look at them. That's it. That's the movie. It's big and dumb. It's got a heart of gold. Set in the Midwest, it's told with real love for that region, as one might expect from the guy who made Minari, Lee Isaac Chung. He's that was a semi-autobiographical movie about a Korean immigrant family that moves to Arkansas. He made this movie. I think this is a good example of the indie guy making the studio picture, giving a little bit of extra soul. It's shot in close-up a lot of the time, so we can see the beautiful faces and the torsos, and then it's shot in wide for devastation of the tornadoes. It's just using all the tools of filmmaking here. Wide and close up alike. Alyssa, before I turn to you, I want to relay a story here. I want to relay a story to you guys and to our listeners. I was discussing Glenn Powell and whether or not he's a movie star with a friend and a listener of the show. We were texting each other. And literally in the midst of that conversation, I'm like texting him in the midst of it, and I went to pick up tags for my car at the car dealership, and the salesman, he remembered I do a movie podcast. He may even be listening to this right now. He mentioned to me that he said, I want to go see that Twister movie. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Why do you want to see it? And he's just unprompted, I asked. He said this to me. He's like, I want to go see that Twister movie. So I said, why? And he said, well, it's got the good trailers, for sure. It's got good trailers. I like those. But I really like that guy, you know, the one from the Netflix movie where he plays the undercover cop. And he went on to admit that he and his girlfriend had also enjoyed Anyone But You, but he was kind of sheepish about that because it's not really, you know, not a guy's movie. It's a chick flick. It's a rom-com. Anyway, leads me to my intro question, Alyssa. Is Glenn Powell a movie star?
Yeah, I think Glenn Powell's a movie star. I mean, to be fair,
the guy from the Netflix undercover cop movie.
Yeah, I think he's got that Zendaya energy, right? Like, I would describe him as one of a couple of younger actors we have seen recently who I feel like can hold the screen, can do a fair number of different things, and who, you know, at least for me, if I hear Glenn Powell is going to be in something, I'm like, okay, I want to see that. I want to check it out. I'm curious about it, right? Like, he's a sort of automatic, I'll at least try it for me now. And to the loose extent that I have a definition of what a movie star is, that's kind of what it is. That if I know they're in it, I'm curious.
Okay. All right. So what did you make of the movie, Alyssa? What did you make of Twisters?
So what did I make of Twisters? I think it is quite a lot of fun and would have been even more fun to see if I had been with a, let's say, later evening and possibly more lubricated crowd, because it's definitely a movie that is quite unintentionally funny, at least a certain amount of the time. It is completely hilarious that all these people who... this is a movie set in, like, right in Tornado Alley, and yet nobody on screen seems to know what to do when there's a tornado, and, like, they always need Glenn Powell to tell them to, like, get into a building or, like, go someplace for shelter. And apparently no place has basements. And to be fair, like, you know, my brain is also slightly short-circuited by the sight of Glenn Powell. And so, like, if Glenn Powell showed up, even in the midst of an emergency, I might need him to tell me what to do in order to, like, get me to focus away from the Glenn Powell-ness of it all. But it's just, like, that's a sort of unintentionally funny thing that runs throughout the entire movie that, like, nobody knows what to do in Tornado. Look, this movie is not as good as it should be given some of the elements involved, but it's probably somewhat better than it could have been. You know, I think it's a little half-baked, right? I mean, it's not quite willing to talk about climate change and the fact that tornadoes are sort of, you know, theoretically getting stronger and more unpredictable. It's, you know, sort of unwilling to talk about, like, causality there. It has this running plot about the fact that a lot of folks whose homes are getting destroyed by tornadoes are uninsured or underinsured. But again, doesn't quite, like, get at some of the knottier politics of that in the way that, you know, a movie like Minari could, for example. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting as a business story right now is that there are a lot of insurers are starting to really face up to the consequences of climate change on extreme weather. Federal flood insurance rates have gone up a lot. A lot of insurers are finding that they're having a lot of trouble purchasing reinsurance, which is their own sort of financial backstopping for, you know, for in ensuring houses and structures in places that are affected by extreme weather. You know, and there is a big sort of reckoning in the US in particular, but globally about, you know, whether it's going to be continue to be sort of financially viable for people to live in the places that they have wanted to live. And, you know, Twisters has this subplot where, like, the ostensible villain is going around buying up people's land after their uninsured homes have been destroyed and theoretically to, like, build new homes there, although God knows how the insurance is going to work out for him. But it's, I mean, again, it's sort of a half-baked idea, partially because, like, is the guy actually a villain if people are going to get no dollars for their destroyed properties? Like,
well, I wanted to talk about this a little bit. I'm glad you picked up on that because it's the most nonsensical villain plot that I can remember in some time. Spoilers, I guess, if you're real worried about. But it's very obvious what's going on at this kind of almost from the beginning. The Javi's company is partnered with some land developer who they're using the... He says he's using the phased array radar thing so they can create better warning systems, I guess. But in reality, what they're doing is they're chasing the tornadoes around and buying up the property, which... and this guy is, like, following and buying up the property, which seems like a very, very complicated, an unnecessary and unduly complicated way of, like, going in and buying up the property, if that's the real goal. Like, if your goal is just to swoop in and vulture up those properties, and we can talk about the ethics of that separately, like, whatever. The idea that this guy is, like, giving them some money, but not, you know, enough to make them whole, but it's more than they would have gotten, and they're not insured. Whatever, we can discuss the ethics of that. But, like, the plot itself is just ludicrous. It's like,
you don't need military-grade radar to find where houses are going to be destroyed by a tornado when they're going to be destroyed in the next 10 minutes, right?
You just send a team. You just throw them in a van and send them down there.
Yeah, but that movie is boring.
I guess.
That movie is like a guy in an office staring at a spreadsheet and occasionally texting his buddy who's like, he's like, hey, go buy that house.
No, this is like the insane idea for the Jurassic Park sequel that was like, what if we made raptor human hybrids and turned them into soldiers? And like,
that movie kind of, a near version of that movie.
Kind of what happens in Jurassic World.
Did end up happening the second.
All right. Anyway,
Legacy
Peter,
trilogy prequel thing.
So, Peter, you had your own emergency in the middle of the theater.
I did. So I had this is a movie about, I guess there's a scene in which a tornado comes and destroys a movie theater.
Yes.
A reflection of or echo of the scene in the first film, Twister, in which a tornado destroys an outdoor drive-in theater while The Shining is playing. It's this great little visual gag in the first movie where the tornado comes and you see Jack Nicholson's face staring through between the door, right, and the here's Johnny bit where he's attacking, you know, the axe down the door, and the tornado just you know sort of carries like blows that whole thing away in this kind of beautiful disintegration. It's a great scene. So I didn't see the scene that happens in the movie theater in the new one because my movie theater got evacuated at almost exactly the 1 hour mark. I was watching this at the Alamo in Boston in the Seaport neighborhood. And the lights just came on, and there was this very loud alarm. It wasn't like a normal fire alarm. It was just like an and it just said, there is an emergency in the building. There is an emergency in the building. Please stay in your seats if you hear another, but like, let us know. I can't remember the exact language, but it was like, if we will be announcing whether you need to evacuate very soon. So I, like, just bolted out instantly. I was like, I'm not staying here. So again, you don't know that if it's a fire, you don't know what it is, right? You just know there is an emergency in the building, and this is a theater that's several floors up, right? So you're sort of stuck up a bunch of escalators and stairs. I did not want to be at the far end of whatever was maybe coming upstairs. So I snuck out the emergency exit that has the please do not use alarm will sound. It was like the alarm is already sounding. I don't care. Through some like unbuilt sort of back exit kind of situation. It got out. It was totally fine. I don't even know what was happening. I assume it was something like a fire because the alarms were going off all over the building. And I did, as I was leaving the area, see some EMS, fire and EMS show up. There were no police cars as far as I could tell, and also no people running and screaming and panicking. So whatever it was, it probably wasn't that big of an emergency, but everybody's waiting outside. There were fire trucks on the site, and guess what there wasn't was the second hour of Twisters. So my opinion of this movie is extremely tentative, and since I only saw the first hour or so. And I confess, I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it either. I was very underwhelmed by it. I thought there were some things that worked. In particular, Glenn Powell was excellent and just brought the kind of energy that this movie needed. I also thought the sound design was very good. This is a movie that really got the big surrounding, that's like just sort of the aural sense of being in the midst of a tornado, really kind of right, that the intensity of it. I don't know if either of you ever went to Universal Studios in the 1990s where they had a Twister. It wasn't a ride. It was a Twister themed tornado experience where you'd go sit in an audience like on some bleachers, and then they would run up. They had like a wind blasting machine that made you feel like you were inside a tornado, and stuff in front of you flew around like crazy and like knocked things over and set on fire, right? You didn't, again, not a ride. You weren't like going in a cart. But it was, the idea was like, let's simulate what it's like to be inside a tornado. And it's kind of interesting to think like that was a big custom ride at Universal. And well, yes, there was no actual wind in the Alamo Drafthouse that I saw the first hour of this movie, and the sound got really close. Like, it's sort of like, it actually kind of felt like, oh man, you're inside the middle of this. I've never been inside in a tornado, but I've been in plenty of hurricanes growing up in Florida, and the big intense winds are very scary. This movie gets at a lot of that. So I like the sound design. I like Glenn Powell. I thought Daisy Edgar Jones was okay but forgettable, and I really felt like all of the tornado chaser secondary characters, this is one of the big feelings of this movie, is the original Twister. Those characters are wonderful. Philip Seymour Hoffman in particular, right? But also, like, the guy who directed Tar plays one of them, Todd Field. The supporting cast is just such a delight in that movie. It just doesn't... I just didn't care about any of those people. I was even, frankly, kind of annoyed by them. And it also, I didn't love the way the movie was shot. This was the other thing. Like, I was just waiting for the big moment of, like, the iconic shot of something happening. And the closest I got in that first hour was the fireworks shot. And even there, it's sort of like moving in and out. Like, it can't hold on a shot for a second. There's some good visual ideas in this. That scene in which they run into the windmills, the power generating windmills. That should have been an incredible, like, sort of terrifying, visually memorable sequence. And I'm struggling to remember a single shot that actually happened in that bit, because they don't really focus on, like, the movement of the objects, right? Like, the sort of the intensity of the impact, the scale of things in that Spielbergian way that you want from a big movie like this. And it just sort of, it didn't come together for me. Again, I haven't seen the second hour, so I reserve the right to change my judgment. And I, in fact, as much as I was meh on the movie, I'd like to see the second hour.
I'll say the second hour does have that big kind of movie theater set piece, which is pretty good. And there are some moments there. There, like, a oil refinery or something gets hit by the tornadoes. Fire everywhere. I don't know. It's not... But I will say this movie, like, the spectacle is less important than, I think, the kind of central will they, won't they between Edgar Jones and Glenn Powell. And I think that's... I think that works. I think that all
romance
works pretty well. I find those two to be very charming. I saw people talking about how like Powell is an empty suit in this movie, and he's like, I'm sorry, like there was a kind of collective I wouldn't say gasp, but an intake of breath when Glenn Powell kind of like rolls out into the rain in that white shirt. You know the shot I'm talking about, Alyssa.
Oh yeah.
He walks out of a house into some rain, and he's got his cowboy hat on and his tight white shirt, and he's walking to his truck, and I'm like, that's a movie star shot, folks. That's what a movie star looks like. And people in my theater are like, ooh. There was like a noise. I don't know exactly what that noise. I don't want to mimic that noise. I'd probably get suspended or something. But there was a noise.
I bet you could Google that noise.
There's a noise.
Like, it was an appreciative purr.
It's like a interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's Twisters. That's my main, that's the big shot of Twisters. That's the big idea.
Yeah.
Glenn Powell cowboy.
No. I mean, it's like I said, it's not as good as it should have been. And it's just like there are a bunch of just real plot weaknesses that are weird. I mean, if nothing else, like, you know, I don't know. There are a bunch of plot weaknesses, and it's kind of a bummer.
Are they weird, or are they kind of expected of a movie that's a sequel / remake of Twister? I mean, Twister is not exactly like high art either. It's, you know, you got this weird kind of ginned up antagonism between the two groups of tornado chasers, etc.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Twisters, Alyssa?
Thumbs up. It's fun.
Peter, first half.
Based on what I saw, it's a thumbs down, though, again, I reserve the right to change that if and when I see the second hour.
Thumbs up. I'm, as the man of the people on this podcast, as the Vox Populi, I gotta say, I'm very surprised by the amount of kind of antagonism this movie has gotten over the last little bit. Not necessarily from you guys, but I see lots of folks very down on it on Letterboxd and in my Twitter feeds. Critics I follow who are normally much smarter than this have been very down on the movie. I'm pro Twisters. I want more of these movies.
I will say, I'm glad this movie got made. It has the right energy. It's doing the thing that I want Hollywood to do in June and July every year.
Yeah.
And I like that it's a legacy throwback sequel that doesn't somehow or another try to make these like the kids of the whatever, the, you know, and it's all like this family extent, right? No, it's just like it's a standalone sequel.
takes the same concept, updates it, new actors, new characters.
Tornadoes, evergreen. We got tornadoes all over, all the time. All right. Okay, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Many thanks. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.